Donalena Kitchen talks about food. Donalena Kitchen talks recipes. Donalena Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalena Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
And you have the great good fortune of listening to the Donalena Kitchen show, which is on KHOI Community Radio. Here we are in downtown Ames at the studios of the community radio station. We're around our kitchen table. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalena Kitchen is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, practicalfarmers.org. And we also are sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. Find out about their annual Burns Night Supper to be held on Friday, January 25th. We'll be there, by the way, at Ryman Gardens. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus.
Yes, yes. Thanks to all the people that support us. We couldn't do it without you. So we actually got a bit of snow, and I believe we're going to get a bit of winter blast here.
I think we're going to get some real snow soon.
See, we complain, oh, well, we haven't got snow. Oh, we want some snow for Christmas. We didn't get that. So here it comes, folks. Get your sweaters, your
hats, and your snow shovels ready.
Get ready. It's coming. I know it's winter because I did my first slip on the snow, sit down on the snow, and absolutely, well, you know, one of those tumbles in the snow. I slipped on the ice. No broken bones. No, I sit down pretty well. Now, this is really strange. I take out my little pile of compost that I'm going to put on the compost pile, and just the act of me flinging it onto the compost pile, I went down like a sack of bricks. It was
you lost your balance.
Got to watch it out there. I was out there, and also I kind of was slipping and sliding, putting the holidays away. You know, take off all those lights and figure out how to put them in boxes and hope you'll be able to find them next year. So, yes, here we are moving into a new year. It's winter, and here we are. So
we've got just the fix today on our show. The perfect thing to do all winter long is, of course, drink a nice warm cup of coffee with your neighbors.
Yes, it is. And joining us today is Nadav Mayer. He is a entrepreneur here in town doing great things, and he is here to talk about coffee. Welcome.
Thank you guys so much for having me, and what a nice introduction, and such a joy to be back here on your show. Really a pleasure.
Well, we haven't finished the introduction. We have to tell them What skill set you bring.
Yeah.
So Nadav has Morning Bell Coffee. So there is a coffee shop on Main Street, and he'll tell us all about that. And then his products are all over town because he imports and roasts, and there's a whole world of coffee going on.
I would correct you to say I don't import directly, but we work with a variety of direct trade coffee sources, and we are a big buyer of green coffee.
Okay, so you know exactly where your beans are coming from, right?
So we buy a variety of coffees that are either organic certified, fair trade certified, in some cases not certified at all, in some cases directly traded.
But there must be a story right with each one, right?
Oh, yeah. But we buy directly from, I think this year we're at three different family farms that we buy directly from.
What countries?
So we have Nicaragua. We did work with Honduras, but we have a new family farm we're going to be working with in Guatemala, and we may work with our friends at Legacy Farms in Honduras again next crop season. And then we buy from a gentleman named Jose Oliveira, and he's in Brazil, and we buy directly from his family farm. And I got to meet him last April, and it's really a beautiful relationship with them. And Nicaragua, if I didn't mention already, Selva Negra Farm in Nicaragua.
So does that mean you actually went to those countries, or is there a place where those guys come? How does it happen?
So I know we're going to talk about this book, The Monk of Mocha, a little bit today. In this book, one of the things that figures largely is the SCA conference, the Specialty Coffee Conference. And this is a once-a-year conference, and it's really the place to be to either hear about things
that
are happening.
It's in North America,
I suppose. In North America, and it's really the place to be for all the specialty coffee professionals the world over. And I've been going for many years, volunteering at the conference. conference for many years, and it's really where I network and find out about a lot of possible folks to work with.
So does that mean farmers come to this conference?
It's about half farmers usually from out of the – and for these guys, often it's like they are trying to find the roaster. So here I show up, you know, with my little tag and it says coffee roaster, and they don't know that here I am, you know, Main Street, Ames, Iowa with my little coffee roaster and a couple of pallets of coffee, you know. They have dreams that I have a huge warehouse and I'm going to be buying containers worth of coffee. So it can be kind of entertaining, but the direct trade folks that we can work with bring their coffee to the States already. So they're already well enough managed that they have warehousing operations in the States, all family owned. And that's the setup that we look for. That's kind of the nice spot for us to work
with. Wait, family owned means that the growers own the warehouse in the U.S.?
Exactly.
They're that big.
Exactly.
And that organized.
And that organized, well-financed, exactly. They're already set up. So as opposed to buying from a farmer that may have a plot of land in Yemen or Nicaragua that has no other infrastructure, I can't buy from folks like that. Yeah. The obstacles are too great.
You're too small and he's too small.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's too many issues there. But we did go to Nicaragua. We brought our daughter when she was 1 year old down to Nicaragua, and we continue to get invited to Brazil. We haven't been yet.
Okay. So fun lifestyle.
Hopefully, you know, we have young kids at home, and, you know, everybody in Ames knows how it is. You have professors in the family, and, you know, my wife's tenure-track professor, so coming to work is great
fun. So we're keeping you here in Ames, aren't we?
I love Ames. We're all in on Ames, and it's been such a fun time, and Ames is wonderful.
One of the inspirations for this show, winter reading is a very nice thing besides drinking coffee in general. There is a book
and
called,
you can read and drink coffee at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. Donna passed this book on to me. It's called The Monk of Mocha by Dave Eggers. A wonderful story.
Quite a little page turner, isn't it?
It's a page turner.
It's an adventure story. It's a whole lesson in coffee growing, tasting, and geography. And
right.
I stayed up all night reading
it. It's about coffee. The author is Dave Eggers, and he's written other really interesting stories. I read a book of his called Zitun, which was about a family wrapped up in the Katrina disaster in New Orleans. And how he comes at things is following interesting people through interesting times. This story is about a young Yemeni man from California. Now, don't think of Yemen right away, because he grew up in California just like lots of other people grow up in California.
But he grew up in the Tenderloin district of San Francisco, which is gritty.
Uh-huh.
Right. So it's not a privileged immigrant. It's a kid that grew up kind of on the street. It's very he had a very rough time in many ways. And so now Dave Eggers, from his first book, was called A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, and it did very well.
Yeah.
And then he went on to establish, I've forgotten what the name, but it's like a writing collective that helps, it's very socially productive in terms of supporting younger writers, especially people without means. And so he's quite well known in the Bay Area for his social righteousness, right, kind of thing. So he keeps telling these kinds of stories. And this book, which is, of course, The Monk of Mocha, he follows this young Yemeni guy that grows up in San Francisco and apparently goes back to cultivate coffee because – and now you have to tell us if you think this is true. Is Yemen the birth of place of coffee?
It's so fun. And this book really gets into some of the history about Ethiopia versus Yemen. The book really talks about Ethiopia being the birthplace of the plant coffee, which I think is pretty much agreed upon, mm-hmm. that the plant came from Ethiopia. That's really the only place in the world where you have native genetic stock of various coffee plants still in wild coffee forests in Ethiopia that you can go visit.
Wild coffee forests.
Right? Doesn't that sound like fun?
Yeah.
But there's really a question whether Mocha in Yemen was the first place that had commercial exports to the rest of the world. So it's an open discussion, and there's a lot of discussion.
There's this gap between there sits the plant and who figured out how to grow and drink this stuff and how do you process it. And so there we are.
There's some good mythology around
that. And Mocha still is a port in Yemen.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. And you think one of the things that's interesting in this book is it really talks about the volumes that are needed, you know, where, you know, the exportable volumes and what we think of in the industry as a normal volume of coffee that we would get. The amount of work, the amount of planting and labor and processing is extraordinary. And that's...
And that is all... I mean, if you just want to learn about coffee, this book is a good place to start.
It really does a pretty... good job of giving a synopsis of the processing and the economics. I think it was really interesting, a good way to kind of show how the farmers have a very difficult time often in the places where they farm coffee to be able to sell their coffee, have a livelihood. And this is such a big problem in the coffee industry.
Same old story. We know this farmer story, I believe.
Yeah. It sounds familiar, right? Yeah, commodity pricing, driving everybody down. And yeah, so there is a C price in coffee, a commodity price. Coffee is traded on the New York Stock Exchange. It's fascinating how that impacts the whole world of coffee. That price is really like the old bean price, as in the lowest common denominator of commodity coffee.
It's like the price of corn or soybeans, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
So what I do and what Mokhtar in this book does, you know, we're really in the specialty coffee world. So we're already buying the top 1% or so of the world's crop in terms of how we perceive those qualities.
So if in Ames you want the top 1% of the world's coffee, Morning Bell has it. We have it right here in town.
You can come visit us at 111 Main Street. Absolutely. But I think the C price really is this commodity price, and that's what all the farmers have to play with that C price in mind. But ultimately, he's selling at a much higher price, Mokhtar in this book. And the coffee we buy is also priced much higher. We pay way, way above commodity pricing.
Well, because isn't it important – first, you have to grow the bean. Then you have to pick them at the perfect ripeness, one at a time, right?
Correct.
And then there's a dry – I've forgotten.
There's all the different processing. You get into wash process versus natural process.
And each bean has to be handled by hand.
Many times. So it's an extremely labor-intensive.
Talk about labor.
Absolutely. And, yeah, it's an incredibly complex system of how those beans get here. But for me as a buyer, I look for certain qualities in a bean. You know, the quality of how it's been raised, the agronomy behind it, the processing, how clean it tastes. And even then, we taste every day. We are sample roasting and evaluating coffees. So we only buy very few of those coffees. You know, so we're very picky and choosy in terms of what we buy that we like. But we definitely respect all the love that goes into all these coffees, even if we don't buy it. And I think the message is you want to be able to know where your coffee comes from. And if you come into our shop and you see the coffees that we have for sale on the wall, we get very specific in terms of not only the country where it comes from, ideally the name of the cooperative or the farmer that's on there, the exact location. And also I like to put the roast date on every bag so people can buy the freshest coffee possible, because you want to use up your coffee within about 2 weeks of after it's roasted. Most of the coffees are not going to go for much longer than that. The natural process coffees that are described in this book, those tend to go a little bit longer. Those we really get a month or even a little bit more than a month.
Tell us what natural process means in coffee.
Dried in the fruit is probably the easiest way to think about it. So a raisin, that outer raisin layer is milled off, as opposed to where you would take fruit and quickly take that outer craisin-like layer off and then ferment it very quickly, usually 24 to 48 hours. And that creates that washed coffee, which is what is maybe 90 or 95% of the coffee in the world. It's a very typical clean coffee flavor.
So what does the other one taste? I'm assuming you can taste the difference.
You can taste it. It's kind of this mixture of ferment and fruit, because you have this naturally fermenting fruit that's drying. So all those sugars are fermenting with wild yeast.
And they go – well, we have to mention that coffee is a bean, very similar to chocolate, same process. There is a bean – and it has a fruit around it, and it's the center of the fruit, which is basically the seed, is what you're getting your coffee from. So
exactly. And it's really – this book talks about the size of a grape. In my experience, they're a little bit smaller than a grape. Or if you think about table grapes, they're kind of the smaller ones that you're going to get on a bunch. But, yeah, it's definitely a fruit. And there's all the wildness and uncertainty in terms of fruit selection. And every country does it differently. Every farm does it differently.
So you have at your store some of the kind that's – what is it called?
So we have several different natural process coffees.
Natural process is where the fruit – and then they grind the fruit off?
So generally,
it's
there's
like
a milling process. Yeah, it's a tumbling that happens whether you do a washed or a natural process. And there's also honey process, which is kind of an in-between process. Honey processed, which this book doesn't really talk about. But these processing methods, what's interesting is you get to the natural and the honeys, they use a lot less water. And water use and water pollution at origin near coffee farms is a huge issue. So the wave of the future, the most ecological coffees are the honey processed and the natural processed coffees.
What does honey processed mean?
So the honey process is kind of in between. There's usually some amount of fruit left on the bean that's going to dry and give you some fruit amount of fruity characteristics.
So that's going to actually go into your cup of coffee.
You're going to taste it. And if you come in and say, what do you got for naturals today? Do you have any Ethiopias?
Naturals.
Okay. And it's a, you know, this is like for coffee nerds, but I think for a lot of times there's the feeling of you can come in, you can have a very clean, basic cup of chocolatey tasting coffee, or that we can take you on this trip to learn all about other brighter flavors and tangy coffees, fruity coffees.
Well, and you may not drink this coffee every day, but it is... I mean, it's. I'm coming in. You're going to educate my palate. Even if I don't come on down in my bathrobe every morning and have my cup of coffee with you, I will. I want to know about these flavors.
Yeah, the idea that coffee has different tastes. Coffee has a wonderful history. The idea that these small beans from the Africa, Middle East, originally. They become very important over the centuries around the world.
Who of us could live without coffee?
That's true. I ran across some information. I think it was a PBS show or something about even during World War I and World War II, the idea that we had found out that the coffee was good for keeping the troops kind of perked up, and it was. The Defense Department took a great interest in the fact we had to keep the coffee market open. And that's just one thing. Just think of the salons in Europe where people learned how to write great things and create great Vivaldi and Wagner had to have their coffee.
I would say it's our primary drug of choice in this culture.
It is. And it's very pervasive. And because of that, it's very pricey. How people... deal in this stuff is amazing. Also, the idea that now we're getting into specialty coffees, coffees for taste, for so long, for much of the last century, the 1900s.
Think the can of Folgers that your mother had on her shelf.
And percolators and just kind of make this stuff.
And it still works. You get your caffeine that way.
Yeah, but, you do.
You have to put some milk and sugar and try to cover up some of those bad flavors. Yeah, it's fascinating. I think there's a seasonality aspect there, too. You talk about conventional priced coffees. A lot of those coffees are very old. The average age of a bag of coffee that's a conventional bag, I think on average, is about 3 years old.
As opposed to specialty
roasters, we really focus on freshness. So we're buying based on when coffees become available, when they first come into port. And we use up all our coffees within a year, generally. And with that year, you know, that's the freshest time to have those coffees. The other thing you mentioned, too, I think, is, as we change, we get to this newer place where specialty coffee is a thing and not the commodity coffee thing. And I think one of the things that to think about with this book, the price of the coffee, right? So he's selling this coffee. The Yemeni coffee is extremely expensive. And why is it so expensive?
Because there's a major war there right now.
You know, the war makes it harder for him, but if it was very basic coffee and not very good, the price would be low. So what you're really paying for is the quality. But in there, too, there's a quality premium, but most of the premium above and beyond that is a novelty premium. A lot of these super premium coffees in the specialty coffee world, whether it's the geisha variety from Panama, which is extremely famous, or, other varieties that are grown. And the varieties meaning the type of plant, just like here, I'm sure there's types of corn and soybeans that people plant. So it's the same thing in coffee. The varieties and varietals that people plant really can have a big impact.
It's like wine grapes, really,
exactly.
Isn't it? Yeah.
So those all have different characteristics and need different things and have different outputs,
and
yield
better. Yeah, if
you
just want your alcohol, it really doesn't matter. And that's true with coffee. If you just want your caffeine, but if the flavor...
Exactly. So you have a flavor component, but a lot of it is the novelty factor. So some of the most expensive coffees, maybe they're the most delicate, but maybe the average drinker is not going to notice. You're not putting milk in any of these coffees. But you put it that way, when you're getting a $16 cup of coffee like the one that he sells. But I saw that Blue Bottle, which is one of the best specialty roasters in the country,
a really interesting story about Blue Bottle.
They're West Coast. Yeah. They have a lot of venture capital funding for them. They're really the darlings of Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. So I saw that they were selling in the book. They talked about selling these coffees for $16 a cup. Also online, in reference to this book and some of the stories, I saw that there's a box set of these Port of Mocha coffees that you can buy from Blue Bottle. And I think it's about $140 for 4 ounces of coffee. $140
for 4 ounces. But this... That's another whole world.
It's an adventure. You can sit at home, though, and travel the world with, you know, for only $100, right?
Exactly.
What's amazing is this book called The Monk of Mocha is about all the human wheeling and dealing. We're dealing with big amounts of money, a lot of risk in a lot of cake in a lot of reasons, and the romance that we have for because of the fact that Mocha is a port in Yemen. The hero of our story is Mokhtar, who wants to go back and go, let's find out about this. And he found out, I believe he found out in his studies that there was truly a monk that was the first guy that decided, let's brew this. Let's make a tea out of this. And my goodness, did his collection of monks and holy men, they were just all perky, and they came up with great thoughts, and they were drinking their coffee. So the monk of, there really supposedly was a monk of Mocha that kind of turned this into a beverage. And this story of this California young man who actually... He's a wheeler dealer. He can talk up a storm. He borrows money. He runs off. He gets thrown in jail. All kinds of things happen to him. But it kind of gives you an appreciation of what it takes to get these little beans to our coffee in the morning.
Well, and the story also talks, I mean, we all know that there's some horrible, sad story going on in Yemen, and you see this, the starving children. I mean, it's just horrible. This book talks a little bit about, I mean, obviously the main character came to the U.S. as a child, so it's an immigrant story. He goes back. He still has family in Yemen. He has to navigate a lot of things going on in Yemen because of the war. So it gives you, I mean, you learn about coffee. You learn about the geopolitics of immigration and war countries, and it's quite
it does humanize. Yeah, yeah. Humanizes the Yemenis for
absolutely.
Sure. And
absolutely.
Another interesting thing, you get some of the rural-urban divide, too, that it talks about that. And that's really fascinating how, you know, coffee is really grown in rural areas and urban people maybe
it's
have
farmers.
Never been to those areas and, you know, I've never seen it. So that's a very interesting thing. A side note to this, I have this memory, you know, I've been going to these specialty coffee conferences for many years, and I was in Seattle in 2015.
Knows these guys.
You know, and I remember meeting them and seeing the picture of the boat, you know, that they came in on, you
good
know,
story,
from the Red
huh?
Sea. And I don't remember if I got any samples or not from them, or if they identified me as way too small time to be deserving of samples. But I remember meeting them and talking to them, and it was very interesting to hear that story.
Oh, my. We are talking with Nadav Mer about a book that we have all recently read called The Monk of Mocha by David Eggers. This is KHOI. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was some music from a CD collection called The French Cafe. And I have to pass this along. The group that was playing that piece of music called En Douce was called the Baguette Quartet, which I thought was quite good. Nice music to drink your coffee.
Coffee. Here we go.
We're at the table today with Nadav Mayer, and he has a local coffee shop, but he knows a lot about coffee beans.
Morning Bell. Great name, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah. So Nadav has a roastery on Main Street, and he is our local coffee expert here today on the show. And anytime you can go and visit him, you can have a – do you do cuppings? What do
Please
you do?
Please come visit. Yeah. So we have a roastery. We buy green coffee from all over the world, and we roast it on site and sell it wholesale but also retail. So you can come in and buy a bag of beans that I just roasted. We also have a specialty coffee service, like a coffee shop counter with an espresso machine, where you can get pour-over coffee, coffee made using the AeroPress method, which is a lot of fun, a variety of fun drinks that we make with the espresso machine.
I mean, you can
lattes.
Get really into this stuff, right?
We have a lot of nerdery that we get into, but we try not to hit anybody over the head with it. We want to be really approachable. So anybody that just likes coffee.
Like, if I just wanted a cappuccino, I could do that too.
Absolutely.
You would
we
let
sell
me put milk
plenty
in my
of cappuccinos.
Coffee.
We have we get milk from Picket Fence.
Of course.
You know, we get beautiful milk. We also do a lot of nitro cold brew, which is a very big thing. And we have experimental cold brew coffee. We do cold brew all year round. So that's a very big product for us that we're kind of known
for. And your coffee is sold in some local restaurants, like the Mucky Duck.
Shout out to Marcus, you know, supports the program here. It's beautiful. And Dublin Bay, Cafe Baudelaire, Farm Grounds over in Nevada is a wonderful place to get our coffee.
Now that's a new.
It's a relatively new cafe out there, and they've been doing a great job.
Is it downtown Nevada?
It's in downtown Nevada.
Oh, we're going to have a road trip here.
And
okay.
They have a bakery, and they do meals to go. It's a fun place.
And good.
Yeah, we feel like, you know, we're going to be hitting the three-year mark in Ames this coming June. And we really feel like we're part of the ecosystem here.
Your,
it's so great.
Your little building that you own, and it is this cute little building on Main Street. And thank you for preserving the integrity of our local architecture. It's 111?
111 Main Street.
So it's on the north side in the first block of Main Street. And it's been in the back so far, but now you are you're using the whole building.
Yeah, so we're in the process of taking over our whole building there. And we had a salon.
And we're working closely with City Hall to get this done,
right? We're working closely with the city, but we used to be, you'd have to walk, and still today, if you come in and have coffee, you have to walk down this long hallway. It's a little intimidating to get to our little spot in the back of the building. But we're going to be having the coffee shop part is going to be in the front of the building, and the production will be behind that and the roastery. And it'll give us a lot more space to store all the green coffee that we have and really the ability to grow, because that's really been an issue to try to do what we do in our small space there. But yeah, growing is going to be fun, and we'll have a shop right on Main Street on the front.
So you bought that building, right? And you have to deal with all of – so, okay, good for you.
Yeah, we're in it to win it. You know, we see it as we're well invested in Ames, and
I'll say,
you know, it's been a lot of fun, and we have great customers here. You know, the people here get very excited about
us.
We
like our coffee.
Yeah,
good.
And so tell us about like all the nuances of like fair trade and what are we talking
about? The idea of getting the idea is to get more money to the farmers, the growers, but after finding out more about coffee, my goodness, it's such a global sort of thing. It's big money. There's lots of risk and investment. So, what are some of the options that you have as a buyer?
Yeah, it's extremely complicated from every aspect. But I think the fair trade question is a biggie. So we work with Wheatsfield very closely. So we have our coffee is available at their espresso bar, and we also sell the coffee by the bag there. And we started working with them before we opened in Ames. And at that time, they said, oh, we'd love to buy your coffee, but you guys aren't fair trade certified. We only want to buy fair trade certified coffee. And, you know, already for years, I've been buying lots of fair trade and organic certified coffees without paying or arranging for me to be able to put that sticker on the bag.
Oh, your business has to be certified.
So we decided at that point to go through and become fair trade certified so that we could put that sticker on the bags that we sell
and
that are certified.
Mostly
like that.
just tracking who you're buying from?
Tracking who we're buying from, but also the marketing component. And, you know, for the fair trade organizations, of which there are two now, large international fair trade organizations, you know, they want to know that you can't just put their label. If you go and buy, you're a roaster, you go buy a bag of green coffee, you can't just throw a fair trade label on it. Mm-hmm. They want to have the ability to track that, and also from a marketing perspective. It's really interesting with fair trade coffee because specifically I like the idea of fair trade, right? Mm-hmm. We're supporting farmers. We're going to pay farmers more money. More money goes in their pockets. Traditionally, there's been this cooperative aspect of fair trade farming where fair trade organizations only would work with cooperatives that were set up as cooperatives, individual growers. So large estates were disqualified, and that recently changed. There are now some fair trade certified estates. But traditionally, it was this whole cooperative model. So it's really a social engineering thing, right? It's like us from the consuming countries, Europe, the U.S. come into these coffee growing regions and say, oh, you guys, you need to change your organization of how you work with each other so that we can give you more money to buy this. And of course, they're saying, sure, we'll be a cooperative.
We'll take that money.
In these countries that have no history of creating cooperatives. And that's kind of what happened through a lot of the 80s and 90s.
Ah.
So now these cooperatives have matured. You know, and some of them are very established, and they work with a lot of established roasters in the States.
Guys, this is just like growing corn. Corn is, you know, we have cooperatives here in Iowa. That's how we market.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
So many parallels with those commodities.
Farmers are farmers.
So what happened with a lot of these roasters, they buy directly from these cooperatives. The focus was never on quality. The focus was on a lot of this transparency and the certification as being kind of a leading thing. So what would happen, a lot of these fair trade cooperatives, they would work with a mill or beneficio in the community where they were. They would get an order, send coffee to Bill, you know, whoever the roaster is. And they know they have a bare minimum price, and it's higher than the average price they're getting for the rest of the coffee. They have no imperative to send them the highest quality coffee.
Ooh.
So the economics of fair trade have always been against quality. So what's happened in the last 5-10 years is more, you know, high-end specialty roasters have really changed the market to make it more of a quality-focused, cup-quality market as opposed to just a certifications market.
And, of course, you pay more for that, right?
You pay more, but also is it available? I work extremely hard to find fair trade coffees that I like. It's really, really hard.
Yeah. So it's got to be fair traded, but it's got to taste good.
It's got to be good.
Woo-hoo.
So we taste a lot that are, you know, we don't want to sell. So
what
I think right now I've got like three fair trade coffees.
How much coffee do you drink in a day?
Not that much, actually. I try to really moderate my consumption, but several cups.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
But I got to do it for work. You know, I'm tasting coffee. We have all the sample roast evaluations and, you know, making sure our espresso machine is lined up and dialing that in every day. So, yeah, we drink some
coffee. So you mentioned this SCA conference, this large conference of coffee growers and buyers. Is that one of the things that is being argued about or talked about, the idea of quality versus price? I mean, what goes on at these conferences?
It's, you know, I've been in business for many years before I was in coffee. You know, I'd worked at some conferences. The coffee industry is unlike any other. And that's one of the things in this book that you can see, too. The people who are involved in coffee have such a passion to a degree that it makes no economic sense.
Oh, my
people
goodness.
People do it because they love it. You know, this is a love business. On every level, growers grow it because they love growing it. You know, they could be growing other crops to make more money, generally, wherever they are. You know, the people who are involved with the importing and exporting and the, you know, all that stuff. Also, every step of the way, it's only the people that are insane and love it do it. So you can imagine you put 10,000 or 13, I think this past year was 13,000 of those folks together for one weekend. It's pretty wild. And in the business, I'm old. You know, probably the average age of a lot of the owners and the baristas and the people who are running specialty coffee operations, you know, I turned 40 this year. The average age is probably in the mid-20s or maybe 30. So when I go, I'm like an old man in the room for sure. But it's a lively group. And I'd say that it's not necessarily organized.
Are they wired? They must
They're
be.
They're wired. They drink coffee all day and then they party all night. They drink. You know, I go to my hotel. I crash. You know, after being on my feet for 16 hours, I'm done. But the parties go late into the night. But the passion is really interesting. But I'd say there isn't really a collective thing there. It's more individually driven. You know, it's a market of all small businesses like me. You know, so that everybody kind of has their own directions. And you can generally find people that are kind of aligned with what you think. But you have to seek them out. It takes a lot of a lot of connections and footwork to know who's who kind of in the business. But at the same time, it's a small pond. It's a very small pond.
Oh, my.
Yeah, only 13,000 people.
But out of that 13,000, maybe 5,000 or 8,000 are coffee growers that maybe they've saved up for 10 years to make this one trip to Seattle, and they bring that suitcase of green coffee, and they're hoping and dreaming to run into someone like me. So when I walk around the floor, again, with a thing on my chest that says coffee roaster, people will grab me and say, I grow coffee in Wei Wei, you know, in Guatemala. Please take a sample and, you know, email me or, you know, get me on WhatsApp to tell me how my coffee is. And it's really a wild thing to go to these conferences.
Well, the process, so they show up with beans or you buy just the beans. Roasting is an art form. Knowing how to brew is an art form. I can understand why it is a labor of love with lots of magic.
Lots of variables. I think that's what you're addressing too. So many variables that it's very easy anywhere in that process for something to go wrong and we lose all that quality. Starting from the grower all the way to what we do in our shop.
Oh my, especially when you think of how things are shipped around the world. I think of coffee in pound bags or by the cup, but you have to deal with what I see big bags of coffee at a roaster, these big burlap bags.
Yeah, where do they come from? How do you get them?
And how much is that?
It depends where they come from. Again, every country has their standard. It can be usually 60 to 69 kilos, so 132 to 152 pounds, somewhere in that range. They're pretty heavy. We get them by the pallet. You know, several as many. So we have trucking companies come. And, of course, they think it's hilarious to try to deliver to Main Street. We have all these crazy things that we have to do to get them in and out of our building. But
so if you buy beans of a certain – say you find a bean in a farmer you like, you have to buy a whole pallet of it.
Depends. I might choose to buy a little bit or a lot, depending how much I think I'll sell. If I buy too much, I might get stuck with it. You know, there's a lot of issues.
So is there a distributor in between that you have to buy from?
Every case is different.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But generally, there's two big warehouses in the U.S. One is in Oakland, California. The other one in New Jersey that probably have 80 or 90% of the coffee stocks that are in the U.S. at any given time. And it's because of the coffee futures trading market. The traders want to know exactly how much coffee is in inventory. Same thing like, right, supply and demand of any of these commodities.
Yeah.
So even specialty coffee, commodity coffee, they don't care. They want to know that it's all there. So often we get from those warehouses.
Oh, right, because you can't – it's got to get from Guatemala to someplace where you can access it, right?
Exactly.
And think about warehouses full. You mentioned storing coffee. What is coffee stored cold, hot? What's the best way to store
coffee? In a burlap bag.
It's so interesting. It's such a good question. So we talked about it as an agricultural product that goes bad within a year, right?
Right.
So one of the big things,
it's volatile oils in it, right?
Exactly. Mm. And all these volatile compounds that are right from the country of origin and from the mill. It mentioned in this Monk of Mocha book about GrainPro bags. It's such a big thing about the packaging. So these bags are heavy duty. They were really designed for grain. But now they've come into coffee and they seal in. So it's kind of a liner inside the burlap bags. And that seals in the freshness. And it's a very important component for specialty coffee. And it's very important for the shipping.
So
because
it's
before
some kind
that, they would take out a lot
moisture
of
moisture barrier
exactly.
kind of thing.
And it really keeps the beans fresh and keeps in some of that moisture. So especially here in Iowa, it's very dry in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to hold too much coffee over the winter because it's going to dry out. I'm going to be losing more of those. So I tend to wait to do a lot of my buying until the spring. And we try to... You know, so managing the inventory and the humidity levels is a thing.
I was going to say, you have to probably run a humidifier and watch the temperatures.
But if it gets too humid, it's a problem, too, because then it can get musty.
Okay, so going from the huge to the very minuscule. So if I buy a pound of coffee, and I'm going to grind them and use them at home, where should I store this stuff?
It's a wonderful question. A lot of people think the freezer, the fridge. So you have those same issues. Coffee is very sensitive. It's going to take on smells.
Ooh.
So if you put it into your fridge or freezer next to that nice smoked salmon that you got from Nova Scotia by FedEx, hopefully, you know, it's not going to be good. Ooh. It's going to have a little fishy vibe to it. So the best is to store it in some kind of airtight container, mason jar. The bag that we sell goes right into a Ziploc bag very nicely that you can zip up and try to use within a week or two. But yeah, generally in a cupboard, room temperature.
Oh, in a cupboard, not
in the fridge.
Out of sunlight. Yeah, no fridge, no freezer, no sunlight, hopefully.
And no, not too hot, not too cold.
Goldilocks, exactly.
Hmm, okay.
And use it up. Use it up
fast. Use it up quickly.
Yeah. One last question. If I come down to Morning Bell tomorrow morning, what is the most exotic? I want to taste the most outrageous, unusual thing that you have. What are you going to give me?
So I would say don't come and taste one thing. Come and buy a flight. So this is something we do every day.
Oh, yes.
So for $7, we will make you 3 coffees.
And I will be wired.
Well, they're slightly smaller versions. They're about 7 ounces or so each.
Otherwise, you'll be a lunatic on Main Street, right?
But we'll make you a variety of different things. And we, you know, at any given time, we've got 10 or 15 different coffees from all over the world.
Okay, what would be in my flight tomorrow morning?
Your flight tomorrow morning, I'd probably put some of our new Ethiopia Natural in there. This very funky, fruity, earthy Ethiopia that has a lot of notes of nectarine, and it's very juicy
so
and vibrant fresh fruit.
So the natural has the fruit thing on it,
exactly.
Which would mean maybe you're getting more of those antioxidants. This could have a nutritional component, right?
It's really interesting. I hadn't thought about the nutritional side.
I don't know, Nadav. You look pretty healthy to me.
I appreciate you saying that. I'll tell my doctor.
Yeah. I drink natural coffee. Okay.
Yeah, the natural process.
And what else?
So we have beautiful coffees from Kenya.
Wait,
from
how many in a flight? 3?
3.
Okay, that's enough to make. Yeah,
Kenya's.
Good.
But then, you know, you come and we also make like a Florida-style cortadito. If you get coffee down in Florida.
Cortadito?
Yeah, cortadito. And that is
that like a Cuban coffee?
Cuban-style or Colombian-style coffee. And that's very popular. We sell a huge amount of those.
Is it super, super strong?
It's strong but slightly sweet, and we caramelize a specific grade of turbinado sugar right into the espresso, and then we pour a short latte.
Oh, we have sugar in the – oh, my.
So we got a lot of fun stuff waiting for you. So when you come get a flight, we'll talk to you. We'll make it special for you, and you get to taste a lot of fun black coffees and other things.
What time do you open?
So we are open every day, 7 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Right. You got to start this early in the day.
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
But still, these tastes can connect us to – the world. It's wonderful.
I am a huge fan of flights or, you know, like even I've done butter flights. You know, if you taste 3 of the same things in a row, you start to understand the nuances and the qualities and good job, Nadav.
Thank you.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
The other fun thing on the flights, I would say, is let's say you're really interested in that Ethiopia. We can brew it 3 ways for you. Because the brewing part is another part that's very mystifying for people.
So many variables.
Right. And people don't know. Do I like AeroPress? Do I want a pour over? Do I want espresso? We'll make you the same coffee 3 ways. And it really helps you triangulate all those different variables and how it sits with you. Because ultimately, you're the one that has to drink it, not me. So I want to help you make it the way that you like it.
Ooh, celebrate your taste buds.
Oh, how fun.
Celebrate your taste
buds. Boy, the education that's possible right here in our own little town.
Mention your name of your shop and where you can be found.
Morning Bell Coffee Roasters, 111 Main Street. Please come and visit. We are open and excited to have you.
And fasten your seatbelt.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. This is KHOI. This is Community Radio, and this is Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about this radio station and about us at KHOIFM.org. Go to the Donna Lana Kitchen webpage and find out more. Faire les gens qui jouent en évitant les coups qu'on se donne à ça en gesticulant sans arrêt. Les mains toujours au bout des bras, bracelets inutilement. À force de remuer, remuer. J'ai mal aux mains, à force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains. À force de remuer, remuer. J'ai mal aux mains, à force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains. Je gaspille mon énergie, je multiplie les efforts pour ne pas avoir tort. Être faux pour mieux faire vrai, c'est bien, mais c'est beaucoup de travail pour rien. C'est beaucoup de travail pour rien, et ça, ça fait mal aux mains. À force de remuer, remuer, j'ai mal aux mains. À force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains. À force de remuer, remuer, j'ai mal aux mains, à force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains et aux pieds.
sauter dans tous les sens devient une espèce de...
Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen.
Yes, we just had Nadev Mayer, our local morning bell, our coffee educator and bringer of good things to Ames. And we were talking about The Monk of Mocha, which is a book by Dave Eggers. And I just want to give a little shout out to my friend Johnny Joyner out in Ojai, California, who sent me the book to read and said, oh, you're going to love this. And so we did.
And we did. Very good. Well, here we are in January. It's winter. And people always ask me, I have a small farm. And I think teachers...
And she doesn't grow coffee.
Teachers get this, too, about the summer. They ask farmers, so, what do you do in the winter? You must get to sleep all the time. And my standard answer to what do you do in the winter is fix what broke in the summer. Because there's lots of new things, a lot of things that need to be done to keep a farm up. And another thing that
farmers...
I thought
you were going to tell me that you read books all winter.
Well, that's all year. And learn new things. The PFI conference, Practical Farmers of Iowa Conference, is coming up January 17th to the 19th.
That is this weekend.
Oh, it always is cold for that, no matter what. So here it is. It's coming up. And there, people get together and learn new things. There's large farmers, there's small farmers, there's grain farmers, there's people that grow flowers. There are people that cook, people that eat. Practical Farmers is an interesting bunch of folks.
But here, we don't grow coffee in Iowa.
No, we don't. No,
a lot of other things, though.
That's okay. So here are some Iowa voices, farmers, talking about the importance of networking, sharing, and learning.
Networking is the biggest thing. You can talk to people from all over that do things differently than you do, and you can find out why they do things differently than you, and you can decide, well, I don't want to do it that way because that doesn't make any sense, or that sounds like a pretty good idea. I think I'll try it.
I think one of the major benefits to the PFI conference is that not even what goes on in the seminars, but what happens at dinner or what happens between the seminars.
It gives you an opportunity just to meet other people and see the problems they have and see the successes they have, too.
And you can network with people that are doing stuff that you think might be interesting and that maybe people around you aren't doing.
Often the things that I implement the next year on my farm have come from some sort of tidbit that's come from another PFI member.
It's a very good learning experience.
I think as farmers we have to cultivate connections all the time. We cultivate connections with each other through collaboration. We cultivate connections with our crops as we learn to help them become more, our farms become more resilient. Everything that I've learned from a production standpoint in my farming has come through connections with PFI farmers. As farmers, we need community, and we need to know that we're not the only ones out there.
There's just a great vibe when you live in a rural community where people want to do things to improve the community, to help each other out.
So I think cultivating connections is seeing the connections that are there, and not only seeing them, but helping to figure out how to deepen those connections.
I really like the exchange of ideas and... It's a little more unique where you feel like in different ways that you can succeed as a farmer.
There's just an incredible diversity of people, diversity of ideas. The sessions range across the board, and so you can always learn something.
Kind of connect with those people that are thinking differently, that are doing things that interest you.
Maybe you're not even expecting it, but somebody comes up and asks you a question, and there you are involved in a conversation you thought you would never have.
PFI provides that option, that resource for community, but it also provides a way to learn from each other, to share meals together.
I don't know where else in Iowa you could get that.
I love the PFI conference because it's a way to connect with other farmers who are doing similar yet different things on their farms all across the state, and coming together in one place and one time to share those resources with each other.
That was some voices of Iowa farmers planning to go to the conference this weekend. You might find out more about that conference, the Cultivating Connections Practical Farmers of Iowa annual conference. Go to practicalfarmers.org. They have a website. Lots of good things going on there.
And I have to say, it's not just for farmers.
No.
I go because I learn a lot about where our food comes from.
Yeah.
And because farmers grow food, right? And knowing farmers really helps you understand what's going on in the marketplace, where this food is coming from, what the issues are, and the issues are complex.
There are. You can be part of it, too. Thanks to Nick Odie for that audio. You heard the voices of Bill Frederick from Jefferson, Iowa, Nelson Smith from Brighton, Kate Edwards from Iowa City, Helen Gunderson from Ames, and Chris Deal from Jefferson, Iowa. So, coming up on the Donna Lana Show, we're going to have some interesting things coming up here in the winter. Next week, tell us what's going to be happening next week on the Donna Lana Kitchen Show.
Yeah, we're going to have Cornelia Flora, who's a distinguished professor of rural sociology, and we're talking about a book called The Neoliberal Diet,
which
builds on a lot of things that we've been talking about in terms of importing and growing today. So that's next week. We're going to be talking about that. The week after that, we're going to do a couple of cookbooks.
Oh, some people just know what I like for Christmas. I got a really nice cookbook for Christmas. And actually, I brought in some cookies of my first experiments from that book. And so I'm going to be cooking and desserting up a storm.
Yeah,
we'll be talking about that.
It's all desserts. And then also we're going to do the new Ottolenghi. Okay, so
tell us about Ottolenghi.
Okay, the Ottolenghi cookbooks are it's a Palestinian and an Israeli open his store in London, a restaurant. This sounds like a joke, but it's not. The cookbooks that come out of that enterprise are fabulous, and particularly in the middle of the winter when you're kind of grogging through, to have some nice, bright, more Mediterranean flavors is really fun. So we'll do that in a couple of weeks.
That's good. I'm looking through that book, too. Donna and I share books back and forth and back. That is a really interesting book. And I love books that have good pictures. That one does.
Right. Make it much easier.
My way of cooking, especially not for baking but for cooking, is to look in the refrigerator and see what I have and then flip through books and see if I've got something that comes anywhere near close. And this Ottolenghi book, I thought it would, that was his name. Otto was his first name, and Lenghi was his, but it's not. That's one whole name. It really has wonderful uses of different flavors, and it's a very accessible book.
It kind of moves you into out of your boring winter rut.
Rut. Yeah, we are kind of moving into a rut.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be that season for a while. And then the dessert book that we're doing, we're going to do it just so you have plenty of time to cook for that for Valentine's Day treats.
Yeah, making
sweet.
A treat. Making a treat. It's good. It's good. So today we talked about a book called The Monk of Mocha. Mocha actually is a port in the country of Yemen.
M-O-K-H-A.
And it was about coffee, not just about the how to drink it and how we think of coffee here, but there's a whole...
Coffee farmers.
Coffee farmers and the trading and the... Oh, good heavens, there are car chases in this and people get thrown in, and there are terrorists and there are shipping magnates and high finance. Coffee is very complicated. And thanks to Nadav Mayer, who runs Morning Bell Coffee. He's our go-to coffee guy. Thank you to him for joining us today around our kitchen table. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thanks for joining us today. This is community radio. This is community-owned radio, community-driven radio. What a concept. What a concept. Support this fine radio station. Go to www.khoifm.org. Find out lots more. Lots of good programming here. We had music today from a CD collection called The French Cafe. We heard selections from different artists, Andus, Malomance, and we'll go out with a fibre de verre by the Paris Combo. So just kind of pretend you are sitting there in a French cafe. Enjoy. Enjoy. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life. J'en fais le serment. J'ouvrirai les yeux, mes deux yeux tout en grand, sur un bel homme, un bel amant, qui laissera ma vie sous tout.